Hi, everyone, and thanks for checking back into the Retro Computing Roundtable podcast. This is show number 3. Our show is where enthusiasts, collectors, educators, authors, bloggers, and podcasters of computer history get together and talk about our hobby. I'm your host, David Grealish of ClassicComputing.com, where I blog and produce two other podcasts, the Classic Computing Show video podcast and Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. I'm broadcasting from the Atlanta area, Johns Creek, Georgia. Let's all pull up around the table now and get started. So on today's show, we're joined again by another great group of accomplished individuals. First, let's meet Michael Nadeau, who's in Salem, New Hampshire, and he is the author of Collectible Microcomputers, as well as he publishes a blog called Classic Tech. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, David.
And I met you one time, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was at the very first Vintage Computer Festival East.
Yes, in Marlborough, Mass, I believe.
So I own your book, and I read your blog, and I know you a little bit, of course, but I don't know a lot about you, so I guess tell us about, am I wrong, or are you a journalist otherwise?
Yes, I'm a journalist. I got started in computers close to 30 years ago. I was out of college. I went to work for a publication you might have heard of called 80 Microcomputing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I basically spent my entire publishing career in tech publishing. I was at Byte Magazine for over 5 years.
Okay.
And I worked for IDC for quite a while, too.
Were you at Byte when it stopped print publication?
No, I was not. I left in 94.
Kind of the last hurrah days for them, huh?
Yeah, yeah. They tried to be too much like PC Magazine, and I think they got away from their roots.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the industry changed a lot, where obviously Byte was one of the magazines that was covered the entire industry and all the different types of computers for
exactly.
A long time.
And they were one of the few publications that really wrote for people who love the technology and explain the technology. And I think that's something that's missing today.
And I'm familiar with the name Jerry Pournelle.
Yes.
What was he the?
Jerry was a longtime columnist. He's actually a well-known science fiction author.
Right, right.
And I believe he still has his Chaos Manor blog going. But yeah, Jerry was quite a character.
He's a guest every so often on Twit, This Week in Tech, you know, with Leo Laporte.
Yes.
So I've heard of him before and read some of his articles and stuff. So thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Next, we'll turn to James Savage, who lives in Niceville, Florida, which is in the panhandle of Florida. And he is the host of the Retro MacCast, one of my favorite podcasts. And doing double duty today, James.
Yes, we just finished recording our episode 185.
You are an old pro.
Well, I don't know. I it's funny how the numbers just start adding up, and all of a sudden you're three years down the road, and you've got a lot of podcasts under your belt.
I mean, does it go like clockwork nowadays then?
You know, it's funny because I think John and I set a record today. We almost recorded the whole show in real time because we were able to do it so efficiently. So I think, we set a record. So, yeah, we can knock it out now. It's funny. And then once you've worked with somebody for so long, you really makes it that much easier.
Yes. And that's what I hope this show will turn into is, there'll be some people that are on more often than others. But I hope to become like real friends with people and it becomes more natural. And,
sure.
You know, like what you're saying with you and John. And along those lines, I have a couple of questions for you. So first about the podcast, just out of curiosity, because in your show, you do it, you know, very professionally, and you have like the little breaks that breaks up the show, almost as if, say, you might run a commercial or something. But, you know, you have the little musical interlude as you change the segments.
Mm-hmm.
So are those always like always at, for the most part, at exact time frames, or are the ones that don't end a segment?
We just put the breaks between segments.
Okay.
Just to put them in, you know, give you little bite-sized chunks. So. Because
right.
It's an enhanced podcast, you can also fast forward in between the sections if you wish, if you really don't care about the eBay auctions or care about what we have to say about the feature that week.
When you chose a style of mm-hmm. you know, of the podcast style, let's say, for lack of a better term, was there any particular style that you took from, like a radio show or format or style or anything?
You know, I'm trying to remember. It was so long ago when I started, and we've pretty much kept the same format throughout.
Kind of to me, it felt like maybe it's a little NPR-like.
Perhaps.
Maybe, but not
necessarily. Yeah, maybe, you know, I think I probably get some inspiration from, like, Car Talk.
There you go, yeah.
You know, exactly. we're sort of click and clack, you know, John and I. So I guess there's some from that. But most of my inspiration came from, you mentioned Leo Laporte. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of my inspiration came from him and his podcasts.
Me too. And I have figured out I can never be Leo Laporte. I've tried and just say, hey, everybody, and welcome back. I can't do it.
Yeah, I got to go on a Mac Geek Cruise. This was like 4 years ago now, and he taught a podcasting class. And this is not—I mean, podcasts exist before that, but they weren't as big as maybe they are now. And I was in a class of maybe there were probably 12 of us, and I was sitting right in front of him as he taught us, you know, the ins and out of podcasting. And that was what really drove me.
And there is no substitute for experience. So you yourself have plenty of experience now in podcasting, and you're very good at it. And Leo Laporte, I mean, he was a radio guy.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Geez, that guy, he doesn't even have to be half awake probably. And
right. Yeah, he could have just fell into podcasting. I mean, he could do it right from the beginning. But for me and John, I mean, it was, wow, if you listen to those early episodes, it was very uncomfortable. It's a lot smoother now.
It's painful now.
Yeah.
One last question for you, and I so meant to ask this of John, but please just tell us a little something about how did you and John meet and then start the show?
Okay, let's see. John, well, he's a graphic designer.
All right.
And he works at a building near me, and I needed to get some work done. I think I had to make some posters or something for work, so I wandered into their offices, and I found this shrine that he had erected to the Macintosh, and he had some original artwork he had done. He had his I think it was a plus, I think his Macintosh plus set up in a corner there, and of course the whole office was all Macs because it's a graphic design firm. And when I saw all that, I had to talk to this guy and meet him, and so that's when I introduced myself. And it wasn't until probably a few years later that I had the idea of the podcast. Mm. And when Leo suggested, you know, to have more than one person talking, droning on about something, that it's good to have a co-host or two. And that's when I thought, wow, you know, John would be perfect. And so I approached him, and then we went from there. And that was 4 years ago next week, I think, since we started Retro Metcast.
Okay. Well, great, because it's a good one. It's a great show.
Thank you.
And you guys have been you kind of took the gauntlet, I don't think that's the right word, the torch, I think, from, like, Retro Bits is, you know, you're now, like, the most regular show, I guess, on air, if you will.
Well, Retro Bits is still around, and he's still, I guess it's not as regular as he'd like to. He's probably busier than than us.
I know how it is.
Yeah, but, I mean, and I love to listen to Retro Bits, because obviously his spans more than just us. You know, we're strictly Apple and,
mm-hmm. and Earl was on the, you know, the first show, and then he's going to be on the next show.
Oh, okay. And you're going to be on our show.
Right. Yeah.
Next week.
Next Saturday. I'm looking forward to that. All right. So let's get to our first item. So I'm going to hand this off to you, Michael.
Okay.
And it's about this sale of the, of an Apple One at the Christie's auction in London.
So, right. Yes. This is a sale that happened, I guess, a few weeks ago. Christie's is one of the biggest auction houses in the world. And just the fact of having a vintage computer at a Christie's auction is noteworthy in itself. But the fact that you had an Apple One, this very same Apple One that sold over a year ago for about $50,000, more than quadruple in price. What's interesting about this is it's kind of had a ripple effect on a lot of systems that you, for example, that you see on eBay. All of a sudden, people think they're going to get rich off of old computers.
You mean I'm not going to get rich off all the junk I'm collecting?
Depends on how long you live.
Not long enough.
One day you will.
Right. But it's what's happening out there is the person who bought the Apple One is a guy named Marco Boglioni, and he's a Italian, he made his money in the computer business. He founded a company called BasicNet, and he's basically a self-defined geek who just loves the old technology. And in fact, he's using this Apple One as a cornerstone for a museum he's starting in Italy. for rare systems like this, this is what's driving prices. You've got a lot of people who made a lot of money in the computer business who are entering middle age or older and are, you know, feeling nostalgic about, you know, what got them started in the business and what interests them. So it only takes two or three people at an auction like this have to have this object, and money is no object, to drive up prices.
And I think Steve Wozniak, I know he was there because it says so, and I'd already read that otherwise, but that certainly had to have had some effect as well, you know, on how much that Apple One sold for.
Yes, and Christie's, of course, is a huge marketing machine, so mm-hmm. you know, they really knew how to drive interest in this.
But does this represent the first, you know, old computer at a mainstream antiques auction? None of us know that for sure. But
it's the first I'm aware of.
Yeah, I mean, it must be.
It's the first I'm aware of, too. There are large auctions where computer-related items have shown up. There's a German auction house, for example, that specializes in scientific instruments and technology-related items, and they've had some large auctions where computer-related items are sold. But it's mostly like pieces from well-known early computers or a lot of important literature that's come up. This is the first like mainstream computer, like a home computer, something that your consumer could go out and buy when it was new.
Mm-hmm. But I think the Apple One, it has a very unique place in the whole, in collectible computers. It, you know, it just from lack of any better thing to relate it to, there's this old postage stamp that was, I used to collect stamps, that's very famous with the upside down airplane on it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You guys remember that from like the teens, mm-hmm. I guess, and it's worth like some crazy amount of money. And I think it's kind of the Apple One of stamps. So there's
right.
very rare, worth crazy amounts of money, and whatever the next most collectible stamp is worth far, far less, though it's still worth something.
Sure. So, can you even think of another computer that we would put at least near the Apple One in terms of value or
not
scarcity?
Not even its original, you know, sort of agreed value of between us insiders, you know, $30,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, what, an original pristine Altair with everything, all MITS cards in it, and I mean, mm-hmm. I can't even imagine that more than $10,000.
But how much of the value? I mean, if Altair were dominating the world today, that original Altair might be worth a lot more.
Yeah, well, you're right. So that's different too, because the company it's related mm-hmm. to, and then
yeah.
the person. You know, one thing that's interesting about this article here by Mike Cassidy, Mercury News, and it's so silly. What does it say here? It looks like, yeah, the actual journalist is writing this. But he starts making the point about, well, you could have bought this many iPads, or you could have bought this many MacBook Air, and that's just so what? You know, you buy this rare Ming Voss, well, you could have bought, you know, 1,000 of those at Walmart, you know, knockoffs. It's just kind of...
It's a silly comparison.
Yeah, and this is the whole point. The guy didn't buy a computer that he could have bought other computers far cheaper, you know, more of them. He bought the Apple One. It almost doesn't even matter that it was a computer necessarily. It's just the device.
Right.
And the fact that it's an Apple. And there's mm-hmm. there's a huge contingent of people who have a large emotional attachment to Apple.
But I can definitely see that the, you know, in say 20 years go by, an Apple computer or Apple is kind of slips away, like, you know, computer companies
right.
come and go. You might be able to pick up an Apple One really cheap by then. Who knows?
Yeah, that's a good point. It may become less collectible. I think it'll still remain valuable, but not. And also, I'll predict right now. I guess I can do that on my show. That how much this Apple One sold for? The next Apple One, that even if it goes in a mainstream auction, I don't think it's going to come anywhere near this. It might get more than the $50,000 of the last one, but I don't think another one's going to sell for over $200,000.
I would agree with that. I'd agree. This one was unusually complete with all the documentation, and it was basically everything you could get with an Apple One. And even though it's not a working system, I don't think you're going to get the same level at another auction.
Well, next we're going to talk about the passing of a computer pioneer and the old iron, you know, pre-personal computers, So his name was Maurice Wilkes, and it looks like, I guess he died just a couple of days ago. It looks like December 1st, maybe, or November?
It was November 30th, yeah.
Okay, so the link that we have, the article is from The Independent in the UK.
Or 29 November, I guess is the, if you want to believe Wikipedia.
And this article is written by Martin Campbell Kelly, who I know wrote a book on computer history, and I'm not sure if I have that. I think I may have that book. He's a prestigious person, I guess, in the computer history realm. So he wrote the obituary for him in The Independent. So what Maurice Wilkes did, one of his most outstanding feats, was that he helped construct or design and construct the EDVAC, or the EDSAC, sorry. Is that right?
Yes. The Electronic Delay Storage Automatic Calculator.
Someone's dog. Is that the same dog I hear in the Retro Maccast that time?
Yep, that's the same dog. That's Widget. So you retract your professional statement.
That dog is a menace to podcasting everywhere. So you're right. So the EDSAC. So the EDSAC is notable that it was. It came after the ENIAC, which is considered the first truly, fully electronic computer. And so then the EDSAC ran its first programs in 1949, and it's notable for being the first practical stored program electronic computer. And I think, Michael, we were talking before the show, so it had the Mercury line, delay lines or whatever, sort of type of storage?
Yeah, it had a, let's see here.
Mercury delay lines, which went on to be used in the UNIVAC.
Delay line memory, yes.
So use of a delay line for a computer memory was invented by J. Presper Eckert for use in computers such as the EDVAC and the UNIVAC 1. So he must have built that along this, the side there right after the ENIAC, because like a lot of government projects, once that got frozen, they couldn't change it, no matter if they came up with improvements.
Right, of course. All these machines were one-off back then, and rather than modify it, usually what happened was you just built a new machine.
And I think, Michael, you said that then the EDSAC begat the Leo.
Right, which was the first commercially sold computer in 1949 in England. And if I remember correctly, it was sold to a food-producing company, mm-hmm. and it stayed in operation for quite some time.
Well, that's a very interesting story. And are you familiar with the story at all, James, about the Leo?
No, I haven't heard that one.
In the last show, I mentioned this great website. So the link is in the show notes of the last show, and I guess I'll go ahead and put it in the show notes of this show since I'm mentioning it. But it's called Top Documentary Films, and so one of my favorite documentaries is called The Machine That Changed the World. It aired on PBS in 1992, and just a fantastic. I just can't recommend it enough. I absolutely love it. It's got a great section about Apple and the whole industry. But the Leo was designed by an English company that made biscuits. They made like jams and biscuits, and they made food. And then they decided they needed an accounting system, and they couldn't find a system to buy anywhere. So they made their own, and they made the Leo computer. And then, I was about to say Leo Laporte. and then it did so well, it was such a success that they added another product to their product line, computers.
Wow.
This biscuit company. And I'm not sure how many they sold, but apparently they did pretty well for a while. And there's a good book about the Leo. I think I have it. I'm trying to look it up here about the computer, though.
Yeah, I think I did listen to the last episode, and so I went tracking down a lot of those documentaries that were listed. I think I watched part of that one anyway.
Yeah, it was called the Leo 1, the Lions Electronic Office 1, the first computer used for commercial business application. And let's see here. The J. Lyons and Company, and modeled closely on the Cambridge EDSAC. So that's kind of funny. All right, so moving along. The Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California has been cranking up their PR machine lately. So if you do a search for computer history in Google, you'll find lots of things coming out of there. So I have a couple of items. They're about to unveil a $19 million makeover. So I think, obviously they're gearing up for this. And so this is why, they have lots of other things going on. I mean, they stay pretty busy doing specialized shows, and they tweet a lot. But it says on Tuesday, January 11th, the Computer History Museum, the home of the world's largest information technology collection, will unveil a 21st century makeover when it reopens this newly renovated building. So have both of you been there before?
I have.
I have not, but I was at the museum when it was in Boston.
Okay. which was just called the Boston Computer Museum, I think, then.
Correct, yeah.
Or the Computer Museum in Boston.
Yeah, I've been a few times, and we did a series of shows based on, you know, walking around and looking at the different exhibits. And it's a long time coming. I mean, the new display is going to be fantastic. When you go in the past, I mean, they had a few interesting exhibits, but it was fairly small.
Right, right.
And the bulk of their stuff was in this area called visible storage.
Exactly.
Where they weren't true exhibits. They were just racks of stuff. I mean, there may be a few name cards here and there, but there weren't really any kind of exhibits like you would see in a typical museum.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really excited. I was going back and forth on whether or not I'd go to Macworld Expo next year until I heard this, and I have another reason to get out that direction.
That's a whole other topic, Macworld Expo. Only appropriate for your show, I guess.
Right.
Because obviously there's a lot of, you know, how successful is that going to be? But this will be the second one without the Steve Jobs keynote, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and the last one was, what was the verdict on that? Was the last one a success then overall?
Depends who you ask, I guess. I thought I had a good time. I mean, it's never going to be the same without a Steve Jobs keynote
mm-hmm.
or Apple exhibiting at all. I mean, they weren't even there. But I had enjoyed my time. So I don't know. I'll probably go back.
Well, me and my wife went to the Vintage Computer Festival. I believe it was 9, but in any case, it was the 2006 Vintage Computer Festival, which is held at the Computer History Museum. And that was November 2006, and it was Apple's 30th anniversary. That was an awesome event, and I got to build Vince Briel's Replica One, and of course Steve Wozniak was there, so I got him to sign my Replica One.
Oh, awesome.
And he signed my copy of iWAS, and I have a picture of me standing with him. And
cool.
James, you know, I've put a couple of pictures in the in your forums. Probably you've seen them before. So there's also a picture of me and Andy Hertzfeld.
Okay.
You know, because he was in the audience listening to Steve Wozniak and some of the five real early guys there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we enjoyed it a lot. My wife really enjoyed it. But you're right. It's what is it called? The storage?
Visible storage.
Visible storage. For people like us, it was still pretty good. But I guess for just people in passing, maybe it would be kind of boring or they wouldn't fully appreciate it as much without, what a lot of museums do with the displays.
Sure.
So hopefully there'll maybe be another Vintage Computer Festival soon, or I'm not going to probably be making it to California for any other reason. So this brings us to another item, is apparently Steve Wozniak, it's in the news. So this is just from yesterday, I guess, where he did a walkthrough of the visible storage, I guess talking about and showing some of his favorite machines in computer history. So that would have been pretty awesome to be a part of.
Yeah, and you can, if you want over to CNET, they actually have videos of him talking about the different items. I know there's a lot of press there. I mean, you can see mm-hmm. in the videos that there were. So there's different articles from different sources, but not everybody put up video. But I did see video at CNET. So
okay.
I think that's the best place to go see his. It's kind of like he's trying out to be a docent there at the museum.
I'm sure they'd have him.
He's a natural.
Yeah, I followed the whole thing on Twitter yesterday. It was interesting.
And in the article I have the link to here, it has has a list of the key artifacts, I guess, that he talked about. The 026 punch card machine IBM from 1949, the Stibitz 1-bit Model K adder, the IBM Rimac actuator and disk stack, the Control Data Corporation 6600 supercomputer. That one's very cool. So I remember that one. I think I have a picture of that one when I went. Yeah, by Seymour Cray, because if I'm not mistaken, that's considered the first real supercomputer, and then he went on to start, Cray after that and build the Cray 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so you talked about Seymour Cray, the General Nova, the Honeywell kitchen computer.
Yeah, and he tells a lot of stories that I've not heard before. I think I've read and about everything you can on Steve Wozniak, and there's a few interesting snippets he threw in there, especially about his experience with the blue boxes. Like how much they charged for them, how many he thinks they sold, and how they sold them exactly. It was pretty interesting.
I'll make sure to get the links to the video. So this brings us into an article in PC World, and this is just in the last couple of days too. And this is interesting, especially I'm sure you both enjoy also looking at like comments people add to these sort of articles. So this is called the 15 Greatest Computer Books of All Time. So out of all the computer books ever written, these are the 15 greatest.
One man's
I'm
opinion.
Sure it covered everything.
Yeah. There's probably 100 books that deserve to be on the list. I actually thought it was a good list. Harry McCracken, who's the former editor of PC World, has obviously been around for a long time and has a long time interest in history of computers. But before I read this article, I kind of made my own list, and I think about 8 of the books are on my list or on his list as well.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to see a computer manual in there among the list.
Oh, the Peter Norton's Inside the PC?
Well, I meant an actual product manual. The Macintosh manual is listed in there.
Oh, I see. Let me go across.
Which, it is a pretty cool book, if you've ever taken a look at one.
Okay.
That really tries to explain how computers work, you know, in a really approachable, simple way for the uninitiated.
Fire in the Valley is a fantastic book, and they're showing, of course, the original Fire in the Valley, which, having written about Ed Roberts and Mitz and Altair recently with his passing, I came to find out that I guess Ed was not happy about some of the things in this book that he felt that weren't correct. But anyway, they updated the book, and I have the newer version, which corrects a lot of that stuff. So that book has been updated and ongoing. And then Stephen Levy's Hackers is one of my favorites, and that's still in publication, has been updated. So actually the cover here they're showing, that's not the original one from 84. In fact, I think there's a newer cover since then. If either of you have not read that book, it's fantastic. And really, this is I've been giving some presentations recently in the Atlanta area to some of the user groups, so I bring this book with me because this book is one of the first computer history-related books I ever read, and I believe it was in around 1991 or so, and it really inspired me. So I was in the Army, and I was going to Germany, so I read it on the flight. So if, 8 hours, I read the whole book.
If you like Hackers, then you should read Dealers of Lightning, which is kind of a West Coast version of the book. It deals with a Xerox PARC.
I have it. I have the audiobook version.
Yeah, it's very well written. It's up there with one of the other books on this list, which is Tracy Kidder's Soul of a New Machine.
Right, and that one's a great book, so I've read that one. Michael Moritz's The Little Kingdom, I'm not sure if I've read it or not. I'm very familiar with it, but...
Yeah, I have that, but I'm ashamed to say I haven't read it yet. And it's a topic probably for a future Retro Maccast.
I've read so many books specifically about Apple and the Next and Steve Jobs and stuff that I still enjoy the topic, but, you know, how many books can you read about it?
Right.
Especially about the older stuff. Yeah, then they have DOS for Dummies on here. Well, you know what? Because that was the very first one in that entire series.
Is that right? Wow.
Now, whether that makes it one of the greatest computer books of all time, I don't know. But if I'm not mistaken, from that very first DOS for Dummies is where all the entire For Dummies empire arose.
Wow. Yeah, you could almost break this into subcategories. Would have maybe been easier to do, like have something that's just how-to books, you know, and then history books. Because it's kind of hard to – there's so many different subgenres within computer books.
And then Robert X. Cringely's Accidental Empires, fantastic book. I have that on audiobook. I have the original version, which I guess dates it a little bit, but that's cool. It's kind of still interesting. So I just listened to that. I think the only cassette player I still have is in my minivan from 2002. So occasionally I'll break out an audiobook on cassette and, you know, listen to it to and from work, you know, until I listen to the whole thing. So, you know, I still enjoy that every so often. And believe it or not, the one below it, Bill Gates' The Road Ahead. Have either of you ever listened to that one or read it, rather?
I have not.
It's good.
Really?
Yeah, and I have the original version of that one, too, because he kind of, he gets beat up a little bit in the reviews or even early on about how he missed the whole internet.
Right.
Maybe you guys remember, you know, Microsoft getting beat up about it. You know, they didn't base anything on their business about the internet after it came on strong in the late 90s. But in fact, he mentions the information superhighway quite a bit in it. But he did update it, I think, a few years later to more strongly speak to the internet and their business and so on.
Hmm.
Yeah, he talks about a lot of the upcoming technologies. And in my opinion, he gets a lot of, and there's a lot of filler stuff too. I can't even remember, but there's a lot of interesting stuff in it too. And I'm trying to think, like, the way he built his home around that time, I think when he got married, is, yeah, I think very much we're moving towards that, where essentially computers become an appliance in your home, and then displays, everything just becomes a display. So, you know, in the future, it's like you don't need a TV per se or a computer, separate computer and display. You just have displays and they can display anything. So he kind of alludes to that.
So you have that CD-ROM then that came with it?
No, I have the book on tape.
Oh, okay. Because that's kind of cool how it came with a CD-ROM, the original book, with that video tour of the house.
Oh, really?
And a copy of Internet Explorer 1.0.
Oh, now that you told me that, I got to get it. Because I would like to see that.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll look see if someone's put it online or something on YouTube. But I have an interesting story. I have a little collectible. I was working in a CompUSA as just a salesperson. And I was I'm a longtime Mac and PC person, so I was kind of the Mac specialist, if you will, pre-Apple Store. But, you know, I sold PCs too, and I was knowledgeable. And this was this pre-Windows 95? I'm pretty sure it was pre-Windows 95. And Microsoft – oh, yeah, maybe Microsoft was bringing in to display and, you know, market Windows 95. I don't remember, but they gave out these little envelopes with this little brochure in it, and it essentially kind of tied in with this book where it was like Bill Gates' vision for the next 10 years. Yeah, I should scan that in. That should be a blog article of mine to scan it in and put it up. But it's very interesting to see what, in 1995, what he saw in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
It says some collectability. Michael, what book would you say should be on here and shouldn't be on here?
I think the biggest omission to me was Dealers of Lightning, because Xerox PARC was so influential to the computer industry. And this is a fantastic story. I learned things I didn't know. On this book, and it's an easy read. There's a couple of books that I probably wouldn't put on the list. One of them was David All's 101 Basic Programs.
Yeah.
Not because it wasn't significant, but because there were dozens of really good basic programming books out there at the time. And his was probably the best-selling one, but I don't know if it was so much better that it deserves to stand out that way. The other one is Peter McWilliams' book. I hated the book. It sold a ton of copies, and I admit that it was very significant in that he really explained the whole computer phenomenon to the people who weren't already part of it, and that's important. But for me, as someone who knows this stuff, it was to me a lot of spoon feeding. So I wasn't a big fan of the book at the time.
Anytime you start using words like the greatest and the top and the best and the most significant, you know, you're going to fall into this. I would agree that the David All book is a very important book, but it's just, you're right, it should have been categorized versus just trying to say these 15 out of all computer books. Like this one, The New Hacker's Dictionary, I don't know. And he explains why it matters, or this person here, but I don't know why it matters still.
Oh, that was on my list.
The Hacker's Dictionary?
Absolutely.
As why it should be there?
Have you read it?
No. So there you go. I have ignorance.
It's not your typical dictionary. There's a lot of history in here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever met Eric Raymond.
No.
He's quite a character, and it comes through in the book. But it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of like a Wikipedia for computing in print.
Okay. I'll have to check it out. Now, the one here, Ted Nelson, the Computer Lib, I bought a copy of that some years ago because I felt like it was significant and I should have it and be collectible and stuff. And it was kind of interesting. But, you know, obviously it was very much a product of its time. You know, other than saying I owned it, I just, you know, I didn't enjoy it in any way. But I guess it was significant.
Yeah, definitely. It hasn't held up well over time. But it was significant when it came out.
And then Peter Norton's Inside the PC. I don't know. They're saying because it's still in print, you know, different variations and such. But still, does that make it the greatest? James, I say you, sir.
Is it the great? I don't know.
Is it the great? No, I'm just kidding.
It is to a PC user that's struggling to get their PC to work.
Yeah.
It very much could be. Yeah, I don't know. You know, a lot of these books are – this is a good list. Some of these books, if you haven't read them, you know, they're probably good to read. Some of them, there's no point in reading them. Obviously, you wouldn't want to go back and read a 1983 copy of Inside the IBM PC.
No, other than from historical context or you know.
Yeah, but it's not like a story of any sort like some of these others. So But there are some good ones in here that I wasn't familiar with.
Let's talk about auctions now. So first, I'm going to quickly go over the four auctions from last time. The first one was a 1961 Remington Rand UNIVAC History of Computers. It mentions the LARC. So it sold with one bid for $34.99. I'm assuming that must have been the opening bid. Yeah, no one else bidded on it. And then second was a vintage IBM Magnetic Core storage memory plane. Oh, it didn't sell. So it had a starting bid of $85, or buy it now for $110. I think we felt that was a little too much, even though it's very nice looking.
It is, and it looks like there's another one, if not the same one, is going to end here in an hour or 20.
Maybe they said that it got relisted.
Yeah.
So one ended for – oh, and I see there's another one. So one ended for $86, and then there's another one ending in an hour for $85. Oh, and it has the one bid on it.
Yeah. That's the same seller, so that's the same one that got relisted.
Okay, so moving on, I think this was Derek. Warren had mentioned this one was a BBC microcomputer Model B with many items and sold for English pounds. So, yeah, it's in UK. So it sold for £51. That's pretty cheap, actually, right? Wouldn't that be like maybe $80? I'm not sure what the exchange is right now.
I think it'll be a little bit more than that.
Probably, yeah. But still not bad for a fairly complete system. I guess it all depends. But last, this one I found very significant is an Apple IIe Swift card. And then it says tested and works a rare find. And it sold for $202.50.
Wow. Did pretty well.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that was the predecessor to the Canon Cat by Jeff Raskin. So it provided a lot of the functionality of the Canon Cat, you know, to an Apple IIe, giving you leap keys and some of that other functionality.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a direct predecessor, but certainly a lot of the concepts there were used in the Canon Cat.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now we'll move on to this show's auctions. So, Michael, you can go first.
Okay, well, I had a couple of here. One of the more interesting machines of the late 70s and early 80s, which is the APF Imagination Machine. APF in the 70s made game systems like the Ataris that you hook up to your TV and played Pong and that sort of thing. But what they did was they modified their system with a keyboard and external peripherals, including floppy drives, and turned it into a home computer. This system that's on eBay has a bunch of software with it. Original box. I've actually never seen one on eBay before, and I think it's quite rare and interesting. However, it's not $10,000 interesting, which is the opening bid.
Right.
A buy it now bid. I would put it in the probably in low four figure range, maybe $1,500, but still. I was happy to see this, but I'm not about to place a bid on it.
What do you think the sellers like this, I guess their strategy is that I don't need to be in a hurry to sell this, so if I don't try, then I'm cheating myself. Maybe someone really will pay $10,000 for this, and so why not try it, and then I can just keep coming down on it until I find the right balance?
I think that's a strategy. There's been a seller who's had a lot of rare and unusual systems mm-hmm. For sale. Vintage PC, I think he goes by.
Yep, I've seen them.
And everything he sells is like several times market value. And I haven't seen him sell anything, but I think that's the strategy, is that you just keep putting this stuff up, and maybe you're creating an impression that it's more valuable than it is, and eventually you'll get a good price for it.
Or maybe you'll get lucky, like the person that bought the Apple One, someone where money's no object. So maybe they'll pop on looking for something like this and go, oh, that must be the going rate, and they just buy it. Because every time I do a search for an Apple Lisa or Lisa-related things, there's an Apple Lisa that's been on there. And just off the top of my head, it's like $3,000 or something ridiculous for an Lisa 2. So that's that person, the guy you're talking about.
Right, and there's a K-Pro on right now, too, for $25,000 if you're interested.
Yeah. Yeah, and he always puts nostalgia. So here it is, the nostalgia, Apple Lisa A6S 0200. Oh, so he's in Toronto. So $29.99 Canadian dollars. Oh no, this is a different person though. This guy is CyberMax 2000. But I know who you're talking about too. So you don't think it'll sell for that?
No, I don't think it'll sell.
And I wasn't familiar with APF. You know, if you scroll down, I do like how eBay, you know, they've changed over the years recently here where it says see more items just like this. And you can see some other, you know, APF devices. So you can see some of the little video game consoles. And I'm thinking that this reminds me of sort of like a Sears system. So I wonder if maybe they made some of those systems for Sears. But, you know, I don't know that for sure.
I don't think they did.
Televideo or something.
Right. I don't remember Sears did have a system. I don't remember who made it. I know RCA made a system for Montgomery Ward. But no, this system, I think, appealed to people who already knew a little bit about computers.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 6800 based system. They had a technical reference manual if you wanted one, so that you could tinker with it if you wanted to. Like I said, it was unique and interesting for the time.
So next is a an MSI VDP-80 that you found.
Right, and a lot of people know about the MSI 8080 system, which was earlier, which is kind of like the Altairn format. And those typically sell, the 8080s typically sell in good shape, good working order for anywhere between $1,000 and $2,000. The VDP-80, not that many of them were made. It came out later. This is an Intel 8085-based system.
Mm-hmm.
It was an integrated unit, and this seller is wrong in stating that it's the world's first fully assembled and ready-to-use computer. there were several before it. It was IMSI's first. And it kind of looks like a TRS-80 Model 3 in format.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's in kind of rough shape. It's missing keys, and it's not working. But still, at $500 opening price, he has a chance of getting that.
Yeah, I think so too. For anyone that recognizes it, because it's very rare.
Right.
Oh, it's missing some keys. I hadn't seen that.
Yeah.
More than some.
Yeah. And the system was actually kind of a headache for IMSI at the time because it had a lot of reliability issues related to it wasn't well ventilated, so it tended to overheat and cause problems.
Wow, even with that big grill there right in the front.
Right.
That
might have been added later.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was looking at those little disc inserts. I guess they were just to protect and maybe lock the heads down for transport. How it actually has the tech specs, like of the drive themselves, written on the cardboard inserts. That's pretty cool.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, I haven't.
If you look at the pictures there in the auction.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that before.
Oh, that's neat. Well, if I wasn't behind on enough projects, you know, then I started this podcast. But, you know, an ongoing project of mine is doing an audiobook of Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer. So I really am about to finish Chapter 3. I'm doing the final editing of it. But in Chapter 3, he talks about this computer. So I had just recently read about this, you know, reading it in. But now, according to his book, he said, you know, they had problems with heat inside and other reliability problems. What's it say? There was a quick redesign installing 5 1/4-inch drives to replace the 8-inch Persky drives and changing the name to VDP-40. But I noticed this says it's the VDP-80, and it has the... Oh, no, it does say 8-inch, doesn't it? Those are definitely 5 1/4-inch drives.
Right.
Yeah, if you scroll down, too, in the pictures, you see there's like a little yellow, like a taped-on, you know, little yellow piece of paper, and it says MSI VDP-80, approximately 17 missing key tops or whatever. And it's saying it has dual Persky 8-inch floppies.
Huh.
So what's up with that? Yeah, look, those are 8-inch diskettes, so those are 8-inch floppies. If those are 8-inch floppies, that's a gigantic machine.
103 pounds. I just looked it up.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it would be $135 to ship to me, and I don't see where the guy is. But anyway, so this is, and I always forget to mention this, so this has got a week to go. Okay. Sorry, we'll move on to you, James. So the APF Imagination Machine has 2 weeks to go. Okay, because it's a buy it now.
Right.
Or make an offer. All right, James, let's move to you.
Okay.
So you have the Transparent Mac SE first.
Yeah, this the Transparent Mac SE, when Apple, at least in the early days, I don't know if they're still doing something like this, but whenever they would, probably not because they can do everything by, you know, in CAD software, but they, when they were prototyping hardware, they would make the cases out of translucent plastic so that they could visualize, you know, the fit, how everything's going to, how they're going to get all the components in there. And you would almost never see these translucent plastic Macs because, you know, they were probably destroyed for the most part. And then, but every once in a while, you'll see one leak out. Quite often, you'll see the ones, I guess, you know, they distribute them as developer items sometimes. And so you'll see them as clear plastic Newton message pads, for example.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the most common clear Apple item I've ever seen.
I've seen a Mac Portable or two in the past, and I think maybe an Apple IIc, but these Mac SEs are very rare. And the seller of this one says he worked in Apple R&D in the late 80s and claims that there were only about 10 ever made, or at least remaining. So they're very rare. And this, I got to say, this is the first one I've seen on eBay in 15 years. So it's definitely rare, and the seller thinks it's so rare that he wants a starting bid of $25,000, which I think is extremely, extremely steep. And there's no make an offer or anything like that. So it's 25, take it or leave it.
Yeah. Why? Why not go and make an offer in there? I wonder. And other people won't know what it is if you turn it down.
Sure. Yeah. But, you know, he's fishing, just like the other people were, you know, just hoping that somebody will, with, you know, more money than sense or whatever, they'll, $25,000 is nothing to them, they'll buy it. But I think somebody with that much money, I kind of doubt they're wandering around through eBay anyway, so.
Yeah, I think, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think this could be driven by the Apple One auction.
Oh, yeah. Well, if that were the case, I would put in there some reference to the Apple One, you know, it makes them draw some kind of loose comparison between the two.
Yeah, the difference, of course, too, is this in fact rare? Okay, yes. Is it interesting? And hey, it's cool even, but does it make it significant enough to be worth that much money? My next little video podcast about to do is on a machine called the Canon Navigator. Have either of you ever heard of that?
I have not.
Okay, well, tune in. So I love it. It's really cool. It's unique. It's a favorite of mine. How much is it worth? I like it. It's worth something to me, but I wouldn't kid myself that it's worth really hardly anything to anybody because it's just not significant, even though I like it. So obviously this is worth more than my Canon Navigator, I think. But you know what I'm saying? It's just not significant enough.
Sure.
No matter how rare it is, there's just the other aspects to significance.
Yeah, I think it certainly could get a few $1,000s maybe to the right collector.
Yeah, that would be my top end. I really couldn't imagine it being worth more than a couple $1,000s, if that much even.
Right.
So, but hey.
I'm sure we'll see it relisted at a lower starting bid here.
And so that's got, so this is actually an auction. It's only got 13 hours, yeah. So.
Of course, the other thing, sometimes it's a guy selling it, and he told his wife he's clearing out his inventory, and so.
Oh, yeah. The old trick, I don't really want to get rid of. Honey, I'm trying to sell it. I've done everything I can to sell it, honey.
All right. So we go to the next one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This one's ended, so unfortunately the listeners can't bet on it. But it's pretty interesting. There's an interesting story behind the Mac Colby. Now, you know, the first portable Macintosh that Apple put out was called the Macintosh Portable, or luggable, as some people call it. But there was actually one before that made by Charles Colby. Mm-hmm. And he would take buy Macs, I guess, and just you know, rip the insides out and repackage them in a portable form factor with a battery and give you a true portable. But this Mac Colby, it was actually available like right at the beginning when the Mac first came out, because according to his website, Charles Colby himself, he was installing a satellite TV system in Steve Wozniak's house in December of 83, okay, so before the Macintosh was unveiled to the public. And I guess Wozniak shared with him what they were working on and gave him a motherboard to experiment with and put into a portable, because Colby had made other portables, MS-DOS computers. So he took this motherboard, stuck it in an existing MS-DOS portable case, ripped out, of course, the PC motherboard, added a couple Mac floppies, and redesigned the monitor so it would work, and showed it to John Scully the day the Macintosh was unveiled to the public. And Scully ordered two, one for himself and one for his son. So Colby delivered those a week later, and I guess Scully never paid for them.
Wow.
Colby went on to sell, I don't know how many or that he went on to sell of these things, but and then later he would come out with another model that was a better customized case that was called the Walk Mac, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
But this Mac Colby showed up on eBay, first one I had ever seen. I wasn't even familiar with the model. Sold for $5,400.
Yeah, now there you go. There's something that actually got that kind of money. I mean, that's still less than $25,000, but and $10,000.
Yeah.
But so.
Still a lot for a collectible computer.
That's yeah.
not of real historical significance, but just, you know, it's a rarity. It's a peculiar thing.
That actually brings us back to the whole Apple One, and like Michael said about just it, related to Apple. It, you know, this is an Apple collectible, and mm-hmm. that in itself drives up, you know, makes it worth more too.
Yeah, there's a bigger audience out there of people
yeah.
collecting Apples and interested in the history.
And it's a global market too. A lot of Mac collectors in Japan, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
And in Europe, it's always remained strong, like in Germany, for instance. Just to talk about Mac clones, which of course it's not really a Mac clone, I guess, because he had to get a real Mac motherboard or take a Mac and take it apart and then just refit it. I used to have something called a Dynamac,
yeah,
which was also a predecessor to Apple's true, you know, portable. And then there was another one, the Outbound series.
Right.
You know, by that point in time, I think you had to be what was called an Apple VAR. So you actually had to have a contract or whatever with Apple and their blessing to a certain extent to buy this Macs at wholesale to then, you know, take them apart and remake them. And then I think, obviously, you voided your warranty with Apple and you had to warranty it. If I'm not mistaken, but this is
yes.
so early on, obviously, I guess he wasn't a VAR or whatever.
Yeah, you could look at even at the pictures. You look at the keyboard that they made. They took that's a real Macintosh keyboard. It's even got the distinguishing discolored spacebar.
Yeah, I like the way that keyboard is shaped too. The way it's kind of cut out or however indented there. It's like a platter sort of a thing.
Uh huh.
It's just very. I don't know. I like the way it looks. It's nice. So moving along, let's see. We're going to get into the two that I listed. The first one. So here's another crazy. Now, this one is interesting. Well, it's not that crazy, I guess, since it's a big collection. But it's called the largest vintage computer collection, over 600 items. Now, what's interesting about this is when I found it, it was just ending. And it did not sell for $15,000. So now the guy's relisted it. It's got 9 days, and he's listed it at $18,000. So how about that strategy? I didn't hype it up enough the first time, so I guess maybe that's the strategy of maybe they'll actually offer me $15,000. But then he doesn't have a make offer. It's an auction. But
and he does make mention of the Apple One auction.
Yeah. This is for serious collectors only, Michael.
Oh.
Okay.
So even if you have 18,000, then you're not a serious collector.
Right.
Stay away.
So just to mention some of the machines, Compaq 8088, Osborne 1, IBM PC 5150, what says this original CGA video card? I'll just go through some of the more significant. An SE, copy of Jim, a 3COM Audrey. That's kind of cool. I have one of those. A TR-70 Model 2, an Osborne. 5155 IBM PC portable, you know, a lot of software, Apple IIe. So, you know, scrolling through this quickly, he's got a Commodore PET. That's not even an original, you know, the first Commodore PET. So, I mean, he's got some significant stuff, but nothing that's jumping out at me is especially valuable.
No, not really. I mean, it's not like there's any landmark computers in here.
Well,
He
has an MSI. So
okay.
There's one. I guess that's at least worth $1,000 or so.
It's got a Lisa owner's manual.
It's got a Heathkit H8. So that's, depending on, you know, without looking further into it, let's say that's worth $1,000. It's especially nice and a lot of boards in it and so on. It's got a box version of Microsoft Windows 1. That does it. I'll take it.
Lots of Osbornes. Wow. Ton of Osbornes.
You have to worry, though, in a lot this large, what the condition is.
Yeah.
How are they stored? How did he acquire them?
And why sell it this way?
Because it would be such a labor to sell it all individually. Mm-hmm. And just hoping he can get the one big score. I mean, if you're going to buy this, you're not buying it because you're going to turn around and try to make money by reselling it. Because the effort and the cost is all in trying to compile all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's obviously spent lots of time. So, I mean, if you're buying this, yeah, you're probably the collector that wants to keep it intact. And you value the time that this person put into to gathering all these systems. And hopefully, like you said, they're in good condition and in some kind of shape that you can display or enjoy them.
That he raised the price, though. That's really odd.
Well, it's going up in value. You know, time has elapsed.
I don't know this person, and I would. Oh, actually, it looks like he does have a Commodore PET, the original one. But I wonder if the strategy could be, you know, I know eBay has lots of safeguards around this, but maybe he doesn't really want to sell it in this auction. Instead, he wants people to, after the auctions are over, reach out and say, look, I'll buy those, these, and these, and these from you. And those, you know, then you don't got to pay any of the fees.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not suggesting that. I'm sure he's an honest seller. All right, last auction I have is a vintage Brainiac K30 computer circuits lab from around 1959, boxed. So far it only has the one opening bid at $29.99. It's got 3 days left. I predict this should sell for at least $100, if not a little more. This is significant that it was designed by a guy named Edmund C. Berkeley. You guys familiar with him?
Yes.
And he wrote a number of articles back in the 50s, and then some books. And guy here mentions giant brains or machines that think. Just a very interesting person that he did a lot of research and things with analog based computing. The Brainiac was, I think, a takeoff of the Geniac. So I think, or maybe they were the same thing, just depending on who they were marketed by. But you know something more about this, Michael?
No, I don't. I'm just reading the description. It says it's a lower cost, lower functional version of the Geniac.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see that. We're toys.
But I agree with you. I think it'll go for several times this price because it looks to be absolutely complete and unused, and, mm-hmm. and usually there's something missing out of these.
Yeah. And so this kit was the predecessor of what you can still find in Radio Shacks and Fry's and online and different catalog stuff, but essentially the electronic kit you would buy for your children to learn something about circuits and arguably computers, but, you know, where you're setting up basic little, not really programs, I guess, but circuits. Sort of like analog computing devices. Have you ever collected any of that sort of stuff, James?
No, this is way before my time. I can remember using one of those Radio Shack little circuit kits. I got one for Christmas, you know, when I was a young lad. But this is pretty neat. This definitely looks like something that ought to be in a museum someplace.
Mm-hmm. Do you collect, James? I think I know the answer to this, but just to ask you for exclusively just Apple things, or as far as computer history related, or I think you dabble a little bit in like some pre-Mac stuff, right? But any other computer history collectibles?
It's pretty much Apple stuff. I mean, there's enough there, and when I started, I really wanted to limit myself so I didn't get too out of control, and so yeah, I kind of drew the line at just Apple stuff.
And Michael, do you actually have a collection?
Not of computers. I tend to collect paper.
Okay.
So I have a lot of literature, brochures, manuals, books, that sort of thing. I used to have a lot of computers, mainly TRS-80s, but a move a few years ago, I had to get rid of them. Couldn't take them with me.
Yeah. That's been my case. I've moved around a lot in a lot of years, and so I've had lots of stuff over the years. I think I've seriously owned about every significant personal computer over the years, and I no longer do, though I have a pretty decent-sized collection. I've been in the Atlanta area for a year and a half, and I've already added to it again. So my two-car garage is pretty much full of stuff. And you know, and I constantly keep the damp rig going out there, and you know, I keep it clean, and I try to take care of it. I just can't have this stuff in the house. I'm just finding things, you know, the stuff is just not going to work anymore.
Right.
Recently, like I said, I gave some presentations, and I broke out my original IBM PC, and I don't have an IBM CGA monitor. I have this other, can't remember the name, but it's real cool. It's got like touch controls on it, and it changes from orange monochrome to green monochrome to like black on white, I guess. And it wasn't working. What else? I just had a lot of stuff just stop working now. And I guess, you know, I could have moved it in the house and maybe that would have been arguably taking better care of it, but I can't do that. But yeah, so at some point it's just all going to break.
Right.
So I think my collection is going to be mostly I have a large book collection and magazines too. Well, guys, we're going to wrap it up. In closing, I just want to thank you both again for being on the show. So just starting with you, Michael, is there anything you'd like to add to just tell us about like what you're up to currently? I know you run your blog, which is a Vintage Tech. Is that right? Or now I'm getting confused.
Classic tech.wordpress.com. Yeah, and what I've been trying to do there is put a lot of the material that I used in the creation of my book, Collectible Microcomputers, the brochures, the scans, and everything else, and I've been updating it as well. In fact, I've got a lot of entries, a lot of the same entries that are in the book are now online. So,
okay. My link to your book's not working. And, of course, the book can still be purchased.
The book is published by Schiffer Publishing.
Have you thought about updating it or putting a new version or anything like that anytime soon?
Contractually, I have to go through the publisher, and they haven't shown any interest in it, in a new version.
It's a great book.
Yeah, I have it too.
So pretty much before your book, you know, the only thing that was out there was Dr. Haddock's Personal Computers from 1993.
Right.
You know, also a good book in a limited way. I mean, it's smaller format, you know, some decent information, but just very arbitrary values, even at the time. But your book is more of the kind of book I like, you know, coffee table sized, but just nicer, bigger pictures and more information.
Right. And I'm trying to do a better version online. It's not really a book, but I'm trying to provide some of the same information online.
Well, in closing with you, Michael, what I wanted to ask is, I mean, just out of curiosity, do you listen to any podcasts, computer history? Like, is there any computer history ones that you listen to regularly and then just doesn't have to be computer history at all?
I'm not much of a podcast person, unfortunately. I tend to follow blogs.
Okay. What blogs do you like that are computer history related?
It's not entirely computers, but I like Retro Thing.
Oh, yeah. I love it. One of my favorites.
Yeah. That's probably the one I look at the most, and I follow a lot of them on Twitter or RSS, but I don't, other than Retro Thing, there's nothing I go to on a regular basis.
Okay. Yeah, I've been following Retro Thing for a number of years because they do cover some computer history stuff.
Right.
I have the Retro Thing. You know what? I have it on. I have my Retro Thing t-shirt on right now. The one where it says, I'm just misunderstood. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Space Invaders, and then it's got the red guy from Pac-Man.
Yes.
And also I bought his Atari joystick that lights up, the USB.
Yeah, I remember that too.
And James, what are you up to other than just your regular Retro MacCast?
That's about it. That's
what?
It keeps me busy. You know,
yeah, every
week.
Do a
show every week, right. It's sometimes it can be challenging. It's funny how it goes, but every once in a while I start thinking, well, maybe I need to either slow down this show or maybe stop it altogether. And then all of a sudden I'll have something will come up and there'll be all kinds of new material to talk about.
Well, and then you have to keep on top of the forums, which stay pretty active.
There's that, right? Right. Yeah. So there's always something to talk about.
Have you guys discussed like doing another video version?
We haven't. I was just thinking about that while you guys were talking, since this is going to be our fourth anniversary. Usually we had been doing a video around like some numerical significantly, you know, like the 50th or the 100th. We're at 185 today, so the 200th won't be for a little while. So maybe for the 200th we'll do something video.
But you're saying next week the one I'm going to be on is actually the fourth anniversary show? Not by number?
It'll be since we started. I think the first episode was on December 17th.
Okay.
So it'll be close.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And then as far as like computer history blogs and podcasts, what do you like?
You know, I guess I don't follow a lot of them since I usually find the news myself and then I'm, you know, prepare it for our show. Mm-hmm. But I do, of course, I listen to Retro Bits. Mm-hmm. I do enjoy that. And then I listen to a lot of Mac related podcasts, of course, that will sometimes cover some historical stuff.
Right.
Like Mac Break Weekly and This Week in Technology. But all my other podcasts are all other hobbies and interests, which are many and diverse.
Yeah, me too.
There's just not enough. There's so much good stuff to listen to. It's just not enough hours in the day to listen to all that.
Right.
That I'd like to, yeah.
Plus, if you're producing stuff, you have to kind of like put it down. There's yeah. something I tell my kids. If you're a creative person, I mean, I'm telling it to myself, of course, too. But, you know, creative people have to create. And I'm constantly reminding myself of that. Like, stop passively enjoying things because you enjoy it, but you're not going to create stuff if you all you do is listen to everybody else's stuff.
Right.
You know. So I'm very happy for this show. I think this is the right combination. I'm very committed to doing this as well as my other stuff. But it's nice to have other people to talk to. That makes a difference. I think you touched on that about you and John.
Yeah.
It was hard me trying to do something totally by myself most of the time. All right, guys. Well, I'll let you go.
All right, well, thanks. That was fun.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being a part.
Thanks,
and I look forward to having you both back on the show. Thanks, Michael and James. I think that's another good show completed. It's still a work in progress, and I believe I'll get better as a host. Plus, the show will evolve and get even better. I would love to hear from you. Please write me an email at david@classiccomputing.com and tell me what you like and don't like about this show. I'm still learning as the show develops, and I can always use helpful critique and format suggestions. I am working on getting the show posted much sooner after the recording session. I learned a big lesson with this episode, as all three of us had very different volume levels, so I had to adjust it and edit every single time a different person spoke. I'm not going to let that happen again. Anyway, please support our guests, Michael Nato, read his blog, Classic Tech, and James Savage on the Retro MacCast. Show number 4 will be recording on Saturday, December 18th. I have a new chapter up for Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer, so please have a listen and check out my blog too when you have a chance. I hope to hear from you. Thanks.